Hello, I'm Claire Armistead. Before we hear this week's podcast, we just wanted to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. For more information on building beautiful websites, go to squarespace.com.
The Guardian.
It can be extremely annoying, it can be distressing, it can be boring, but it's part of who I am.
I don't necessarily hear voices, I hear my voice. I mean, almost every situation, if I have a thought, it will always be translated in my head as though I was talking, as though I was hearing myself.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Books Podcast. This week we're all hearing voices. Novelist Francesca Kay takes us into the strange world of surveillance, where a spy tasked with listening in to a family home finds himself captivated by a disembodied voice.
Light footsteps, the swish of a curtain being drawn. A few words spoken, only just above a whisper, Helen talking to herself. She does this often, murmuring some words far too low to be overheard, with a slight inquiring uplift in her voice.
And we delve deep into the echoey chambers of our minds, following the psychologist Charles Fernyhough as he explores our inner worlds.
Hearing voices is a meaningful part of human experience.
What are we talking about when we talk about inner voices? According to Fernyhough, many of us do at least some of our thinking in the form of sound. In his latest book, The Voices Within, he argues that this constant babble is forged from the conversations we have with ourselves, conversations which help us to think, plan, and create our own identities.
What is that voice in your head? The one you hear when you're slicing carrots in the kitchen, waiting for a bus, clicking through your emails, or grappling with a dilemma? Is it you speaking to you? Or are you the thing that is endlessly spun by that conversation? In which case, where do you go when the voice stops? Does it ever stop? Who is the me, or you, to whom a young child speaks aloud? And who is the speaker? Especially in the stage when that fragile self is still in the process of being formed. Who speaks to the novelist in her study, or to the psychiatric patient in his hospital room? To the churchgoer praying silently in her pew, or to the ordinary voice hearer listening in to the transmissions of a fractured self? What are the tattered, dissociated fragments that auditory verbal hallucinations bring into being, protect against, and help us to understand?
Surveys have found that as much as 84% of the population report that they sometimes hear voices. But what does that really feel like? Guardian audio producer Rowan Slaney tuned into her inner ear.
I'm sometimes unsure whether I've actually said something or thought it. And I used to, when I was in the shower and I was singing and having a great time like everyone does, I would sometimes think, did I actually sing that or was that in my head? And it would really stress me out, particularly as a teenager. It was a constant state of being unsure. Because it is always just my voice or what I think I sound like in my head. I never recognise the music in my head. I have no idea where it's come from. It never has a start or a beginning. It's like, musically, it's just, here is some music. And it's always classical. It's always with strings and this and that. If I'm reading a book, that was interesting, all the characters have my voice, but I can easily, don't get confused by them, but they don't have their own distinct accents, actually, unless it's me putting on an accent, you know?
There's an uncanny magic in the way a page can transmit a voice across the centuries. So how do writers capture a character's patterns of speech? When Fernyhough came into the studio to talk to Richard Lee, he began by reading a passage from the book that explores his own experience of hearing voices as a writer of fiction.
I do not hear voices. I never hear words being spoken and then turn to look where they might be coming from, only to find nothing there. I've had the reasonably common experience of hearing a voice calling my name when there was no one around. And I have quite often hallucinated the presence of one of my children at my bedside, particularly when they were small. I have a vivid inner life, but I always know where the chatter of my internal conversations is coming from. I'm not a hallucinator. I hear people speaking, though, people who aren't there. They don't address me directly, but I can hear how their voices sound, their accents and tones of expression. I know they are not really there because I have invented them, or at least I've hashed them together as creative composites of lots of different people I've known. I give them names, faces, and histories. I know what music they like listening to, how they dress on a lazy day, and what they keep on the sill of their bath. On the pages of a novel, I can tell them what to do. That doesn't mean they can't sometimes surprise me. I never mistake these fictional characters for real people, but I do hear them speaking. You could say that I need to hear them. I have to get their voices right, transcribe them accurately, or they will not seem real to the people who are reading their stories. One fiction writer puts it like this: as the writer, it is as if I'm eavesdropping on a conversation or conversations. I don't make up the dialogue. I hear the characters speak and write down what they say, like a shorthand typist taking dictation. For another writer, communing with fictional characters is a more subtle process of tuning in. It is intimate, like being let in on their thoughts. They don't speak to me, I don't speak to them. It's more like being given access to their interior lives. The characters will say what they will say, and so will the story. I remember laughing out loud that day on the tube train at a funny line from a story I'd been working on. The thought came unbidden, so much so that it surprised me into a public display of mirth. But how? You can't tickle yourself because you know, probably through the same mechanism that usually ensures that you know that your inner speech is your own, that it is you who is performing the action. If you already know the joke, you shouldn't laugh at it, unless perhaps it's a reliable classic that has made you chuckle before. If I'm making myself laugh, there must be some element of surprise. But how, if I myself have generated the idea? Surely I know what I'm going to think. I'm choosing these words, aren't I?
The cliché of someone who's hearing voices is that they must be mad, but you're looking at a much broader phenomenon than the auditory hallucinations that accompany some severe mental illnesses. What kind of experiences does the term inner speech include for you?
The term inner speech for psychologists refers to the kind of ongoing conversation that many people report having in their heads. Not everybody reports this experience, but for lots of people it's going on a lot of the time. And it's the ordinary stuff that goes on as we're just, you know, wandering to the bus or lying in the bath or preparing vegetables in the kitchen or whatever. It's that conversation that many of us seem to be having with ourselves. There is this more unusual, some would see as more extreme experience of hearing voices or auditory verbal hallucinations. And there's a really important theory that says that at some level they're the same thing. So the theory goes that what happens when you hear a voice is that you produce some inner speech, you produce some of this ordinary internal conversation, but for some reason you don't recognise it as your own work, you don't recognise it as something that you yourself have produced. And there's some good evidence to support this. There's evidence from psychology, from neuroscience. There are some problems with the theory as well, and one of the problems is that people have talked about inner speech in relation to hearing voices without having a particularly detailed or nuanced idea of what inner speech is.
So this inner speech that's going on all the time, that, you know, is chastising me now for my stumble as I think about the next question, where does this all come from?
Asking where inner speech comes from is one of the ways we can get a handle on this really fascinating, complex experience. So I was inspired as a psychologist by the great Russian psychologist Lev Vygotsky, who had a lovely simple theory about where inner speech comes from. He argues that children start off engaged in dialogues with other people from the first days of life. They talk out loud with other people working through a problem, and then over time that dialogue becomes internalized, so they start to talk through the problem for themselves in their own private dialogue out loud. And then a bit further along in development, all of that starts to happen completely internally, completely silently. And that's where inner speech comes from.
Oh, and that's a theory you just basically buy?
Yes, I think there's a lot of support for the theory. There's lots of good empirical evidence for the theory, and it fits with a lot of the things that we're starting to learn about inner speech. So if you ask people about their inner speech, which people haven't really been doing, we were very keen to start to address some of these questions about what is inner speech like, and we asked people in surveys, we've done various studies on this question now, and we find that people do report that their inner speech has this sort of dialogic, conversational character, and that's exactly what you would predict if inner speech has a social origin. The conversation that you have with yourself really is a conversation, and it comes from the conversations you've had with other people. And that's critical because it means that inner speech will have this dialogic quality. It means that inner speech will involve representing other people internally. You're having this conversation between other points of view, other perspectives in your head. And then that helps you to understand why, in the case of hearing voices, these different social representations, these representations of other people can suddenly pop up and start talking back.
Because even from the very earliest years, we're always social animals. We're always talking to people. We're always thinking about other people.
Exactly. And that's how that shapes our thinking. That shapes the way that we use language in working ourselves through a problem, in regulating our own activity, regulating our emotions, geeing ourselves up for action and so on.
But what about, that's a kind of developmental story. What about the evolutionary story? What's the place in human history?
It's really tricky to try and get a handle on how all of this stuff might have evolved. I mean, there are certain things you can say. There would be good selective advantages, for example, if when you do your thinking, you can do it silently. Because if you're talking to yourself out loud and there's a predator around the corner, you're not going to last very long. So, I mean, you can speculate about selective pressures that might have led us to internalize, and it's also very easy to see how certain social cultural pressures will lead, for example, when children start school, you don't particularly want a room full of 35-year-olds yabbering away to themselves the whole time. It would be quite hard. It's hard enough being a teacher without that kind of thing going on. So there's a sort of socialization pressure for this stuff to be done internally.
That's a very kind of recent development. My school is not really happening out in the savannah, is it? Is this the kind of timescale you're thinking about? It's a comparatively recent development in evolutionary timescale that builds on pre-existing capacities.
I really don't think we know. We haven't got any decent evidence on that. I can speculate about certain evolutionary advantages to internalising this stuff, but we really don't know.
You're very careful to stress that the experience of an inner voice comes in many different forms, that it can feel very different to different people at different times. Is this one of the reasons why it's so hard for science to get a handle on the phenomenology of inner speech and indeed of consciousness more generally?
I think people have tended to assume that inner speech is just one thing. They've had a rather impoverished view of it. The scientific work that's been done, the brain scanning work, has tended to get people to get into the scanner and talk to themselves, like repeating sentences, like you might repeat a shopping list to yourself. I think inner speech is much, much richer than that. It has lots of different functions, it evolves, it develops in a particular way. So it's going to be a much more complex, interesting, nuanced phenomenon. So we've got to try and put that stuff back into the science, and that's what we've tried to do, for example, in our studies on the dialogicality of inner speech. We've done the first neuroimaging study that tries to unpick how these social cognition processes, in other words, that representing of other people's perspectives, how that works when we do dialogic inner speech. So we can get there, but we need to put a richer conception of inner speech back into the science.
Yeah, because if you ask someone to do an artificial task, then you'll get the pictures of the brain doing this artificial task, which is not necessarily just the same thing.
Yeah, and we did a study recently where we used a particularly sophisticated way of capturing people's inner experience as it happens spontaneously, and I write about it in the book. This method's called descriptive experience sampling, and you sort of train people up on how to report in great detail on moments of experience. And we were able to do this in the brain scanner. We were also able to give people the standard inner speech task, which is just go into the scanner and say to yourself something like, I like swimming, I like swimming, I like swimming, over and over again. Fine, it's important, it's telling us something, but it's not telling us much about regular, ordinary, spontaneous inner speech, I think. And what we found is when we compared what was going on in the brain when people did the standard inner speech task, so-called, with when we were able to capture inner speech as it was happening spontaneously, not because people had been told to do some inner speech, but because it was naturally happening for them, we found totally different patterns of brain activation. And that raises the question of, how are we going to get better at measuring inner speech, but also all sorts of other kinds of experience. As you say, if we're interested in consciousness more generally and the qualities of experience, we've got to get better at this stuff.
One of the things that's interesting in the book is that some people who say that they do hear voices, they reject the idea that the inner voices that they do hear, the hallucinations that they sometimes hear, could be, as they say, just inner speech.
Yeah, my response to that is there's nothing just about inner speech. I mean, it's quite understandable that people say this. Their voices can say horrible things, abusive things, annoying things, sometimes positive things, sometimes funny things. You know, people have said to me, I know this voice can't be me because I could never think of anything that funny. So how can that be your own inner speech? And what I want to say is, let's think differently about inner speech. Inner speech is something that can surprise you. Inner speech is something that can have this extraordinary variety. Inner speech captures the many different selves that you are. You're not just one person, you're all these different selves, and inner speech brings that into being. So let's give the inner speech theory a bit more of a chance. And at the same time, let's think about the very different varieties of hearing voices. I mean, hearing voices comes in such an extraordinary variety. There's this myth that voices are commanding, that voices tell you to do stuff, often nasty, dangerous stuff. It's just not true. Some voices are like that, but they're in a minority. Lots of voices will do other things, like just describe what's going on to you, or say positive, enhancing things, or just be a bit annoying. They come in this extraordinary variety. Voices aren't even always verbal. Voices sometimes take the form of singing or murmuring or whispering or sounds that aren't even human, animal, bird, nature sounds. And there are even voices that don't have any auditory component at all. There are voices psychiatrists call soundless voices, where somebody has a sense, a strong sense, that somebody is speaking to them, but there is no auditory component to that at all. And this kind of phenomenon makes us think, well, you know, we need to think about this extraordinary variety much more carefully. But also, we need to stop being hung up on hearing voices as an auditory experience. It's not just about hearing stuff. It seems to be more a sense of being communicated with. It's a sense that somebody's trying to tell you something, somebody's trying to communicate with you. And that's where all this interesting stuff on the social nature of voices and inner speech comes in.
I guess the question of what it's like is a really tricky question for scientists brought up on the kind of triumphs of reductionism.
When I started working in this area, people would say to me, you can't possibly study inner speech. How on earth are you going to do it? It's by definition unobservable. It's by definition intimate and private. How can you have a science of it? And there were good reasons for taking that view. It did seem like a pretty hard thing to do, but things have changed. We have new methods, experimental methods in psychology. For example, if you think inner speech is involved in a particular task, you can try and knock it out. You can see what happens if you block someone's language capacity and then see if that affects how they do that task. You get a handle on how people use language internally in that kind of way. You can study it in children. You can do various sort of neuroscientific methods as well. So we've got a lot more information about inner speech. There is a science of inner speech now that there wasn't really kind of 20 years ago.
And it's, a way of getting a model that is complicated enough to capture the complicated phenomenon without being too complex you can't really understand it.
Yes, absolutely. And I think as long as we move away from the idea that inner speech is just this churning out of language to no particular purpose and with no kind of social quality. Sometimes our inner speech is probably like that. When you're rehearsing that shopping list to yourself as you walk around the supermarket, that's what you're doing. But most of the time, your inner speech is much, much more complex and much more interesting and brings in all these other cognitive capacities. And is involved in emotions as well. Inner speech has a huge role to play in regulating your emotions, in motivating yourself, geeing yourself up, turning yourself off, but also expressing emotions. Some inner speech is just about expressing emotions. I've been ill fairly recently, and I noticed that my inner speech just became a sort of internal whinging. I was just kind of moaning to myself in my inner speech, and I was just saying really simple, emotionally expressive words, just expressing my kind of misery. And so inner speech can do that. It's useful. It has a function.
One of the other things that inner speech is useful for, one of the ways in which it shows itself, is in the manipulated experience of reading fiction. How does the modern understanding of inner speech that you describe match up to the long history of artists consorting with the muse?
Certainly when we read, one of the reasons I think that fiction entertains us and delights us is that it sets all these voices going in our heads. Many people report that when they read a novel, they hear the voices of the characters. So in a recent study that we did in collaboration with Guardian Books and the Edinburgh International Book Festival, we found that roughly 1 in 7 of a large sample of people said they heard the voices of characters when they were reading as vividly as if there'd been a person in the room with them, which is quite extraordinary, really. People are having the really vivid voice-hearing-like experiences as they read fiction. And there's lots of good reasons why this might be the case. We know quite a lot about the science of reading now, and we know that words on the page do activate representations of voices in the brain in this kind of way. So one of the ways in which writers are able to do what they do is that they activate these voices. They fill our heads with voices in all sorts of ways. When it comes to the question of how writers get to be able to do that kind of thing, again, something like voice hearing can seem to come in. So we also asked a bunch of writers at the Edinburgh International Book Festival about how they heard the voices of their characters. Did they hear the voices of their characters? And lots of them said that they did. Sometimes these experiences were very vivid. They weren't necessarily voice hearing experiences. People would often say that the characters' voices came to them more as a sense of tuning into something. The writers would say that they were able to kind of tune into what a character was saying or would say. It was almost more like an eavesdropping on a conversation rather than being directly addressed. But we're only really just starting to understand and to try and find out about these fascinating experiences. But they do seem to be a big part of how writers do what they do and how readers get the enjoyment from fiction that they do.
Is this experience of hearing these voices in your head, of going through an emotional journey because of them, does this experience have any kind of therapeutic value or change you in any way?
Many people who hear voices these days gain a huge amount of support and guidance and inspiration from the International Hearing Voices movement. And one of the tenets of that movement, which has been growing up for the last 25 years or so, is that hearing voices is a meaningful part of human experience. It is not an aberration. It is not psychopathology. It is something that happens to people in all sorts of different contexts. It happens to people who are struggling with mental health issues in some cases, but it also happens to people who are inspired. It happens to people who are creative. It happens to people who, in the old days, were hearing the voices of the muses. It happens to people who are hearing the voice of God. It happens in all these different contexts. It happens to children who are engaging with imaginary friends. So it's a natural part of human experience. Doesn't mean that everybody does it. Doesn't mean that everybody has that experience, but lots of people do, and it is meaningful. That's the key thing. And I've spoken to many people who hear voices who have found this a liberating, a life-changing change in perception. They're changing the way they think about their own voices, and they're kind of reclaiming their experience and saying, you know, don't you psychiatrists over there tell me what my experience means. I know what my experience means. I know it's not mental junk. I know it's not just the outpourings of a diseased brain. I know it's something that is important to me, that is part of who I am. It can be extremely annoying. It can be distressing. It can be boring. But it's part of who I am. And ultimately, a lot of voice hearers that I speak to say, yes, this thing is really a real pain for me, and it's sometimes really quite unpleasant, but I don't particularly want it to go away. It's part of who I am, and I found a new way of making sense of it as part of who I am.
What about this manipulated version, the controlled dissolution of the self that is reading fiction? Is that something that can have some value in terms of people with a mental illness or people with problems in their lives who can, through reading fiction, can reconnect with society, with the outside world?
I wouldn't want to get instrumentalist about the value of fiction. I think fiction exists for its own sake, and we shouldn't. I think scientists in particular should avoid trying to argue that it's there for a particular purpose or it has particular benefits. Fiction is the amazing thing that it is, and we shouldn't try to instrumentalize it. I think it is true that fiction allows us to be something other than the thing that we are. It allows us to move into different worlds. It allows us to take on different voices. It allows us to move beyond the boundaries of the self and then, in a controlled way, come back to who we are. I think that's the case for both writers and for readers, and there's that fascinating symbiosis between the two in the way that writers will allow readers to move beyond the boundaries of the self and then come back to who they are. Some people in a recent study found that the activation of these other voices in the process of reading fiction was actually quite troubling. Some people who responded to this survey said they found that this inner voice of reading quite troubling and intrusive and had actually kind of turned them off reading fiction. I don't think that's the case on the whole. In a survey that we did recently, we found that we gave people a chance to say whether they had vivid experiences of reading voices, and then say a bit more about them if they wanted to. We gave them a chance to elaborate, to take as many words as they wanted to describe and explain this experience. And when we analysed this, we found that quite a lot of people reported an experience of kind of taking on the voice of a character or a narrator and taking it beyond the reading experience and taking it out into the world with them. So reading a narrator, particularly strong authorial voice, for example, and then going out and in daily life, kind of seeing the world through that narrator's point of view. So the book, the fiction, the narrative was being taken with them beyond the confines of the reading experience, taken out into the world with them. And for a lot of people, that's a very exciting, affirming experience.
You're a writer of fiction as well, yourself, aren't you? Your latest novel, A Box of Birds, explores questions of memory and identity in a story about a fictional brain structure called the Lorenzo Circuit. How has the developing knowledge that you've gained about the role of inner speech affected your own writing?
I certainly thought a lot about the process of hearing the voices of characters. I think, you know, for me as a writer, I do need to hear them speak. I can get all sorts of things right about the plot, but unless I can hear those people talking, then it's not going to work. I just don't believe in what I'm doing until I can hear them speak. Quite how you get to the point where you hear them speak is a really tricky thing. There's no easy answer to it. It's about bringing them live. I think it's partly about bringing them live in every tiny little detail. I mean, I mentioned the fact that you'll think through as much of the richness of a character's life as you possibly can. You know, what do they keep on the sill of their bath? What music do they like listening to? That doesn't necessarily go into the book, but you need to know it because that character needs to be alive for you so that in a particular situation, you know what she's going to say or do. So it is incredibly important to hear the voices for me. And I think I'm conscious of having fun as a writer or being interested as a writer in the transition between the internal and the external. So as a writer, you can get inside a character's head, of course, but you can also show that character in the outside world, interacting with other people. And one of the things that writers have fun doing, I certainly have fun doing, is showing a character saying something or doing something externally in public, but thinking something utterly different, thinking the complete opposite. And I think that's one of the ways in which writers play with that tension between the inner and the outer, and how they get some of the effects that they get.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you want to build a website, you have many options. But if you want to build it beautiful, there's only one. Squarespace gives you the power of world-class design, so you can do more than create a website. You can set yourself apart. See why some of the world's most influential people, brands, and businesses choose Squarespace. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.
Another writer who's getting inside her characters' heads is Francesca Kay. Her latest novel, The Long Room, takes us back to the London of Margaret Thatcher and rusting cars, the Cold War and the IRA. Here we find Stephen, a spy at the Ministry of Defence, charged with analysing the tapes from bugging operations up and down the land, at the end of a long day.
In the silence, the sound of the tape docking into place is loud. Stephen presses play and the tape begins its slow passage from full to empty reel, emitting as it slides a sibilant hiss. He replaces the headphones he had for the time being removed and plugs the jack into its socket. Yesterday, Thursday, early in the evening. Oh, thou art fairer than the evening air, my Helen. The sound of a key turning in a lock, a door being opened and then closed again, and something dropped, a heavy bag perhaps, water running from a tap, a kettle coming to the boil, a teaspoon clinking in a cup, light footsteps, the swish of a curtain being drawn. A few words spoken, only just above a whisper, Helen talking to herself. She does this often, murmuring some words far too low to be overheard, with a slight inquiring uplift in her voice. Although he strains to make out her meaning, it is only her tone he catches, a woman asking herself questions who does not stay for answers. Stephen relaxes like a peaceful cat in Helen's presence. The 5:40 news on television drowns out all other sounds. Stephen and Helen listen to the news together. Andrei Sakharov and his wife Yelena have ended their hunger strike. Michael Foote has won his call for an investigation into militant tendency. Stephen has already heard that news, and watched it too, on his own television at 9 o'clock last night, but he listens to it again with Helen now. When the news is over, she turns the television off. Stephen commends her discrimination as a viewer. More water sounds. Helen washing up her cup. Then soft, rustling sounds that he has heard before. She is leafing through sheet music or the pages of a book. Now it will depend on her frame of mind. Some evenings, when Helen is at home, she practices piano. On others, she will sing. Stephen loves her playing. He loves it when he hears the soft knock of wood against the lid prop, her indrawn breath, and then her first experimental scales, and the way she takes one phrase and plays it over and over again, bold chords or silvery sad notes, but he is ravished when she sings. He does not know much about music and can seldom put a name to piano piece or song, but he is learning. He has bought a turntable and some records. One day he will talk to her about them. In the meantime, he shuts his eyes and listens to her songs of love in languages he does not always understand, but which speak directly to him. It is by magic, Stephen thinks, that this woman's voice comes straight to him from a room that he has never seen and catches at his throat, that it stirs in him a yearning that is new, unnameable, a hunger of the heart. It makes her feel so intimately close. It tells him everything about her. And yet, although each time she tells him something new, Stephen knows that he has always known her. From the dawn of time their souls have been entwined and waiting, now hers is calling him. Helen sings for him alone. On occasion she may play the piano for her husband, but when he is there she never sings. This evening she has chosen the piano and she stops as soon as she hears her husband at the door. Greenwood is late. It is 1933, a time that Stephen writes on the report sheet. Greenwood drops his crackling outdoor clothes beside the door. He has had to finish off a piece of work that couldn't wait. There were problems with his wretched bike chain. He has oil all over his hands. He'd like to have a shower before he rings his father. Will he have time for that, or is he spoiling supper? Supper is the word that Jamie Greenwood uses. The noise of a cork being pulled from a bottle is curiously disgusting. Cooking sounds, a knife hitting a hard surface and a match struck, the hiss of a gas jet, hot fat splutter, china against china, metal against glass. Greenwood makes the telephone call that Stephen has already noted, although on this orange label tape only his end of the conversation can be heard. Stephen closes his eyes as he listens once again to the confident male voice, the sound of shared assumptions. Let that Saudi millionaire be a hopeless shot, he thinks. Let him swing his gun round wildly and hit Jamie Greenwood. Let Greenwood fall to the hard ground dying, bleeding from the mouth. Does blood spurt out in a scarlet halo, in a shower of red raindrops when a bird is shot? Smells good, Greenwood says. Name it, Stephen urges. He wants to know what Helen will be eating. The scent of onion softening in butter, of herbs and garlic, reaches him through the thin grey ribbon and reminds him he's very hungry. What is the wine they are drinking? He thinks Valpolicella for the beauty of the word. When Helen and Jamie have finished their supper, it is 9 o'clock, and they, like Charlotte, like Louise, like Stephen unconfessed, turn on the television for Brideshead Revisited. If they speak to each other at all during the hour of the programme, their words are lost in swooning music and the actors' voices. Charles and Julia are falling deeply and adulterously in love on board a ship in mid-Atlantic. Stephen leaves them to it and winds the tape forward to the point where Helen and Jamie make preparations for the night and shut their bedroom door.
So it was something of a shock to me to realise that the 1980s had become a historical setting. And how did you think your way back into this remote period?
It is extraordinary that it should be a remote period. For me especially, I feel that it was quite recent history, but I know that there are a large number of people for whom it might as well be the Middle Ages. I thought very hard about what it felt like for me when I was young. I'm a little bit younger than my main character, but not much. And trying to get back into that particular London just before the Falkland War, the London of the year that Prince Charles married Lady Diana, after the miners' strikes and dustbin strikes. And I read quite a lot of contemporary newspapers, actually, rather than books, because just leafing through the archives of newspapers tells you all sorts of things that one had entirely forgotten, you know, like what was number one at the time, or the sort of, or what was on television. So I tried very hard to rethink myself into that atmosphere.
Because it does feel so very far away. I mean, putting on tweeds and brogues for the country, or the wimpy on Piccadilly Circus. But if you actually sit down and do the maths, then the early 1980s are as close to the 1950s as they are to us now.
Yes, well, it's, as I say, it's frightening, the passage of time, but it is, and it was a different world. It was a completely different world. There were so many things that we now have, of course, that were just not even thought of. Computers are the obvious ones.
But, I mean, it really is back in the analogue age. I mean, the hissing reels of tape, the weekly bulletin for the office, printed out on paper rather than sent around an email. Was that part of the appeal of the setting?
Yes. I think it would have been impossible to write this particular novel in a completely contemporary setting, mainly because the technology is so different. And I wouldn't begin to be able to even imagine myself into that technology. But it's a different world, too. It isn't just that the trappings of the world have changed, that we now would never dream of sending messages around an office by, you know, pinning them on notice boards. But it's also that we have all changed as a society. This was still the time of the Cold War. It was still a time touched a little bit, perhaps, by a sort of post-war sense. It was the time before the great boom of the 1980s. It was a time before, remember yuppies? Anybody remember yuppies? You know, it was sort of on the cusp of that change. And so I think it was essential, really, to go back to that period rather than to try to update things and somehow, in the world that we live in now, it just wouldn't have worked.
The spies themselves seem very old-fashioned as well. They're laboriously typing up their reports. They're collecting tapes together. Rollo even suggests that it's not really on bugging a chap's bedroom, which just kind of seems unimaginable today. Is that where the novel started, with these slightly old-world spies?
No, it didn't. I'm not massively interested in the spies themselves. I'm much more interested in their kind of milieu, in their setting, in the spy land, which has been so often visited by so many different writers. It's a land which entirely lives in an imaginary context, and obviously inhabited by giants, or portrayed and depicted by giants like Le Carré or Graham Greene or, you know, Conrad most originally. So I was interested in the setting, but what sparked the novel was really more to do with just people at that time, rather than any interest in what they might or might not have been doing within genuine intelligent settings.
It was the flavour of the character.
Yes, it was really, it did strike me as a, you know, as a young woman, especially as a very young woman at university, how the sometimes very bright and imaginative and sort of young men with poetic souls got lost, sort of fell underneath the feet of the perhaps not, in fact, more confident, but superficially much more confident, the long-legged young men who had come in their cohorts from the grand schools of England and stayed in their cohorts and felt this, or seemed to feel, a sort of entitlement and an ownership, which the others may not have done so much. And that is really that idea of isolation and loneliness and wanting to be somebody else and not being at home in your own self, in your own skin, is really what was at the heart of the novel. Then I needed to find somewhere to put that character.
The idea that Stephen is in the same world as these people, but totally disconnected from them.
Well, the world is a disconnecting world in itself. That's why it's such a useful setting, because it's a world, in the phrase that is so often used, borrowed from T.S. Eliot, it is the wilderness of mirrors. So it's the world in which people may or may not be telling you the truth, or they may be what they seem, or they may be pretending to be somebody else, and they're doing that all for a professional cause. And Stephen, who is not doing any of these things, who is doing a really dull job of just listening, is inevitably going to be affected by what is going around him, and it adds to the sense of unreality that leads him to this sort of amour fou, this mad but nonetheless entirely genuine love.
With this disembodied voice. I mean, the novel is an extended hymn to the power of sound, with Stephen bewitched by Helen's voice before he even sees her. Is there something about the novel that's uniquely suited to exploring sound?
It's very interesting, a challenge. When I began the novel, I thought I would try to have much more music in it, literally music. And that didn't quite work, because writing about music is even harder than writing about art, which is what I did in my first novel. I wrote about paintings as though they were real paintings, so the novel was extremely visual. this was, to some extent, an experiment with myself to see if it could be a novel that would work through the ear. And yes, I did think about the voices and the different voices and the way in which they're so hypnotizing or seductive. Now, there are ancient Talmudic prescriptions against listening to women sing.
Mm.
And there must have been, you know, buried somewhere a reason why, in strict kind of observance, you weren't allowed to do that.
I was wondering if there's something about the similar illusion that's at work with audio when you listen to something on the radio and when you're reading a novel, this illusion that the voices are speaking just for you.
Well, it's true. That is a very true feeling, isn't it? When you listen to somebody reading something to you, and it does definitely feel that there isn't another audience. And that, you're absolutely right. That's exactly what Helen is doing for Stephen. And in a sense, he is also right. When he is listening to her on her own, he is listening. He is the only person listening to her.
And that's exactly what the reader is doing at the same time. Because as they read the words, the sounds of the words, in some sense, are generated in their head.
Yes. Yes, and the aim, of course, would be to make the words musical in themselves in terms of their rhythm and the structure of the paragraph, so that there's a certain musicality, I hope.
Now, do you sound out your work in your head, in your own head, while you're writing?
I sound it out loud again and again and again. It must be maddening for anybody who happens to be anywhere near. But it's the only way to hear it, to hear the rhythm, is actually to say it out loud.
And what about when you're reading? Do you think you're listening inside your head as you read the work of other writers?
That's an interesting question, and I asked myself exactly that just a couple of days ago. Yes, though in a not terribly focused way, because otherwise it would be too slow. And, you know, one wants to turn the page. But yes, I do think I hear the words much more than I imagined before. And it isn't just black and white print.
Having gone back to the 1980s and found these grey spies doing their grey thing, I wonder if you think that the dangers that they faced back then, which seem so much more kind of manageable than the dangers that we face now with the dreadful things going on in Syria and the spectre of the Paris attacks, do you think that the world has shifted since the 1980s in terms of the imminent fears that surround us?
I think part of this extraordinary feeling that this was actually ancient history is that we have forgotten how dangerous the world was in the 1960s, 70s, 80s. And even those of us who were adults or young adults at the time perhaps didn't quite realise what the generation before us did realise, and which we now know from having read more history and seen archives that have been opened, how very near the world could have come to serious catastrophe. One of the things that I thought about a lot while I was writing the book was the way in which the opposing sides in the Cold War, particularly the Soviet side, really could believe that, for example, say, a NATO manoeuvre might be cover for invasion. For
the beginning of the end.
The beginning of the end, you know, for apocalypse. And that pervasive danger, which I think characterises the Cold War, is something that we've probably forgotten in the more imminent danger. I'm not for a moment trying to say one was worse than the other or making any kind of equivalence. And now, you know, the danger is sort of imminent. But the idea of that the whole world, as we know it, just could end, is something that we probably don't feel now.
One of the ways in which you make it feel, the setting feel more vibrant, is by reaching often for the present tense. Was that something that came naturally, or was it a conscious effort?
I'm afraid it came naturally.
Don't be afraid.
I would have liked to say that there was a proper scheme to that, that at some kind of level I had plotted it all out, but it does come more intuitively and instinctively than perhaps is proper to admit.
The novel does slide between sections in the past and the present,
yes,
and sometimes almost future tense is being used. Is that also partly the disconnection between what Stephen's listening to, which has been previously recorded, and where he finds himself at the present moment?
Yes, quite often it changes if we are in his head or we are seeing what he is seeing. So if you're an observer with him of the action, it is usually in the past. But I'm not even going to pretend there's an absolutely hard and fast rule that would pass, you know, a stickler for correctness. It's not that I didn't realise. It's just that where it becomes immediate or slightly distanced, the tenses somehow shift.
So are you returning to the past with what you're working on at the moment?
I'm thinking of writing it so far in the past that it won't be quite such a question of timing and particular detail.
No, not so much dredging your own memory as finding memories elsewhere.
Finding memories elsewhere, yeah.
Francesca Kay's The Long Room is published by Faber. The Voices Within by Charles Fernyhough is published by Profile in the UK and Basic Books in the US. Next week, comedian and writer Sarah Pascoe talks about her new autobiography of the female body, Animal. For more literary discussions, you can find us online, install us on your tablet, or stick us on your smartphone by searching for Guardian Books Podcast. Until then, from me, Claire Armitstead, and my producer, Susanna Trezillian, thanks for listening and goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.